Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Eric Umansky, an editor here at ProPublica and occasional podcast host. And I'm very excited to have Bill Keller, the editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project here, as well as Joe Sexton, a senior editor here at ProPublica. We're talking today about the story that they jointly edited, an unbelievable story of rape. It's about, and cover your ears, or better yet, stop listening if you haven't read the story yet, and now go read the story. Okay, welcome back. It's about a woman named Marie who reported being raped and then was not only not believed, she was then charged for falsely reporting the rape. Welcome, Joe. Welcome, Bill.
Nice to be here.
Great to be here.
You know, the first thing, and you guys have spoken about it a little bit, and the reporters on the story, who I should say the two reporters are Ken Armstrong from the Marshall Project and T. Christian Miller from ProPublica. But I'm curious how this unusual collaboration came about. I heard there was a kind of awkward email that started it. Joe, you want to speak to that a little bit?
I think I authored the awkward email, which Bill the other day was kind enough to send it back to me and thought maybe it should be framed. But I think the subject line was a delicate, thoughtful question or something like that, which basically meant I was, you know, going to mess with Bill's world and wanted to start as gently as possible, because it turned out that our two reporters working independently had both come upon aspects of the same awful, incredible story, and neither of them was going to be inclined to give it up. And actually that was Bill and my first reaction, which was to individually say to ourselves quietly, let's be first, screw the other guy. Bill and I spent roughly a quarter century together at the New York Times, and there's still some of that DNA in us. And it's, you know, natural and admirable enough. We're all in a competitive business, but at least on our end, it was T. Miller, our reporter, who actually broached the somewhat radical idea that we could behave rather less like conditioned competitive journalists and more like people, adults, who could put the interests of doing the story best before all other interests. So that was the subject of the note I sent to Bill.
And Bill, you know, your reporter had been working on it, as I understand it, a hell of a lot longer than we had. Talk about it from your perspective.
Yeah, well, it obviously helps that Joe and I have worked together and trust one another, so that it didn't completely knock me off my chair. But, you know, my initial reaction was the kind of classic type A alpha dog journalist impulse that we got to get this because we have it first. And I was mostly worried about breaking the news to Ken Armstrong, who had this on his list. He lives in Washington, where the story takes place, and was aware of it for a long time, had it on his wish list, to-do list, for a year and a half. The idea, I was going to call him up and tell him that maybe he should share it with somebody else, was a daunting prospect. But fortunately, I think he probably swallowed hard at first, but he very quickly realized that there was more to be gained by pooling our resources and really telling the story right rather than rushing something half-assed into publication. And he knew T's work. The two of them, I think, knew each other and, you know, were fans of each other's work, so that helped a lot.
You said Ken had this on the top of his list for a while, and obviously T was spoken around. I'm curious, from both of your guys' perspectives, it's not a traditional breaking news story. You're not. It's a thing that had gotten some coverage. So how do you decide, yeah, this is a story that we should go big on, regardless of whether you're working with another news organization or not? And what compelled you guys each to the story?
Well, you know, there are certain story ideas that get pitched to you that you find yourself telling your friends over dinner, preferably not your competitors, but you know, just friends of your family around the dinner table. And this was one that never failed to draw some sort of gasps from folks over dinner. I mean, it's just, you can't say that the story writes itself, but the story is sort of obviously just a terrific drama with some important underlying lessons about rape and the way we police it, which is often badly.
Sort of classic tradition of investigative journalism to go back and uncover historical scandals, abuses, and while there had been very little local coverage, the story was had never been told. No one had spoken to Marie, the victim, and in many ways the one of the heroines of the story. The cops had never been identified by name, who had mistreated her and then charged her. The story of the two female detectives from Colorado, one could often see them as competitive, differing jurisdictions who came together, put aside rivalry, and did the best investigation possible. Their story had never been told. So it was certainly not going over familiar ground. Almost every word of it was new and harrowing and important. And while I am touched to be a guest on the show, and I know Bill feels similarly, sometimes journalists talking about how a story comes to be and how they put it together can seem a little overly self-regarding. The person who deserves credit for the telling of this story is Marie. She'd waited a long time to tell it, and it took an awful lot of courage and fortitude and trust to do it.
You know, one of the things that you guys obviously dealt with in the story is your two male editors, your two male reporters on the story. I'm curious how you guys navigated that, what issues came up, you know, what might have changed in the process.
I think everybody was acutely aware of that from the get-go, and not least because the two police detectives who botched the case of Marie's rape were male, and the two detectives who cracked the case were women. I think both of us made an effort to make sure that a number of women read the drafts as we were going along and tried to see it through the eyes of Marie or somebody else who had had that kind of horrific experience. And Ken, I know, shared some of the interview material and the nature of the story with a number of people in his city.
You know, and there are, it's a nice thing to reflect on, there are, in both our organizations, women in senior positions of authority and judgment. Bill had Kirsten Danis not only read the piece, but give it a really great edit. Robin Fields, who's our managing editor, read the story at every important stage. And it was then subsequently copy edited by a woman who had some tremendous thoughts and to whom we turned at the end when we were debating just exactly how to tell and at what level of detail the final chapter in the story, which is the rape of Marie. And the copy editor wrote back a really thoughtful and ultimately persuasive note. I actually have it here. I waited about 10,000 words up to chapter 8 to know what exactly happens to Marie. I needed to know, not to imagine it, the hard and, yes, tough facts of her story. And I wasn't disappointed. I was captivated, sick to my stomach, angry, and I couldn't stop reading all the things I was supposed to feel. The writing of Marie's rape was simple, not dramatic for the sake of drama or dry like a police report. It was raw but polished. I saw everything, but not the uncomfortable details. It moved fast, but not too fast. I felt all the pieces of the story, the similarities and the previous mentions of her rape, fall into place after reading it. It was quite powerful. And more importantly, it made her no at the end, and her rapist's sentencing all the more satisfying to me. So that was great to hear from the editor and really factored into our decision to write the final chapter in quite a bit of terrible but apparently necessary detail.
I mean, one thing, and the copy editor mentioned this, is, you know, you guys also made a decision to do a different kind of story here. I was sort of thinking of it as a kind of anti-internet story in a certain sense, which is, you know, you put trust in the readers to hold what amounts to the reveal, to the 8,000th word or whatever it might have been. You know, you didn't put a banner headline on it in that sense. You didn't have nut graphs, as we call them, at the top of the story that said, that ramped up outrage to 11, that, you know, this was a narrative tale. And I know, Joe, I saw someplace else where, and Bill just mentioned it, that you had sketched it out. But I feel like our impulse a lot as journalists, particularly investigative journalism, can move away from that.
Well, one of my favorite lines from my life at the New York Times was a senior editor there saying at one point that, of the Times, that it was a place full of rules that didn't exist. And if you stop for a second and think about it, it's actually a fairly profound thought, which is that whether it's in that institution or in other forums or occasions or other institutions, people sometimes feel constrained by constraints that they only imagine. It seems if it's a small tragedy of a place like the Times that people abide by rules that don't exist, it would be even worse if we abided by rules that didn't exist once we were outside of the Times. In the experience and art of storytelling, you know, you might as well dare to try something different because there's no good reason not to.
You know, one thing that really stood out, I try to be a little careful about putting too much faith in the metrics, but as near as we could tell, not only were people by the tens of thousands clicking on this story, they were staying with it and reading it. I think a lot of them read it to the bottom, which is just the, you know, testimony to what a well-told story it was. My favorite of all the tweets and Facebook comments that I saw on this story came from Laura Lippman, the Baltimore-based novelist who knows a thing or two about storytelling. And she tweeted, "I never had a doubt where it was going, but it made me cry in public." I think a lot of readers figured out early on that we weren't going to be telling this story about, you know, fake rape charge. But it still managed to sustain your suspense and engagement all the way from the top to the bottom for an awful lot of readers.
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, and one thing, Bill, you had mentioned that the story is obviously about this case and these cases involving this horrific serial rapist and about a set of cops who do it right and a set of cops who screw up. But one of the things is how lightly you guys touched on that larger theme. It's in the story. You don't dwell on it. You guys let this story and the reporters let this story basically tell itself and focus on the story itself. Was that a conscious decision? I'm sure it was on some level, but how difficult of a choice was that?
I don't think you have to tell people that they're supposed to be outraged in order for them to be outraged. And this story is a great example of that because people got the power of the story, and the comments from readers saw this as indicative of a tragic shortcoming in a lot of policing of rape. Just to sort of drive the message home, we published some supplementary material, including a list of lessons that have been learned, sort of best practices of policing rape. The reporters did a dig conversation with an expert on police handling of rape cases. So, you know, we didn't lose sight of the underlying theme. You don't need to holler at people to get them to be moved by something. And sometimes just letting the story tell itself is much more emotionally satisfying than hammering at it.
Great. Thank you guys for coming, and thank you for listening to the ProPublica podcast. We will see you next time.